Silence in the courtroom. The meeting will come to order. Thank you all. We have a quorum, and Representative Anderson, would you like to move the minutes of February 26th?
So move the minutes of February 26th.
Are there any objections or corrections to the minutes? If not, please shut your cell phones off. If not, all in favor of adopting the minutes, please signify by saying yes.
Yes.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. We have a bill up, House File 774, Representative Atkins. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon.
Representative Lundbeck, would you like to move Representative Atkins' bill so we have it before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 774.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Lundbeck, for moving this. My understanding is it's on its way to the Commerce Committee. We do have an author's amendment that would put it in the shape in which I'd like to proceed. So if Representative Lundbeck or somebody else would be kind enough to move the...
Representative Lundbeck, will you move H.O. 774A2 amendment?
I'll move that, Representative.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. All in favor of... no, we used to incorporate that, so go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Lundbeck, for doing that as well. The bill is fairly simple. It just clarifies existing Minnesota law to do something that we thought we've been doing for a long, long time, and that says that manufacturers are not to own dealerships here in Minnesota. We've already got a bit of an unbalanced playing field between manufacturers and dealers, where the manufacturer has considerably, and understandably so, they're giant billion-dollar corporations. They have considerable power. This, on behalf of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, just tries to strike a level balance, a level playing field between the two by saying that manufacturers are not to be owning their own dealerships here in Minnesota. That's why we've got dealers. It's been a relationship that has gone on for decades and has worked out very, very well for Minnesota. It's a good amount of revenue that comes into Minnesota, good jobs that are at those dealerships. And with that, I have Mr. Milner here on behalf of Minnesota Auto Dealers Association to testify in favor of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Atkins, counsel informs me that it's absolutely necessary for us to take a vote on that amendment. So all in favor of the Atkins amendment, H.O. 774A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The amendment is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Milner.
Thank you, Representative Atkins, and thank you to Chairman Earhart. My name is Jacob Milner, and I am with the Minnesota Auto Dealer Association. What we're seeking to do in this bill is just clarify the intent of the Motor Vehicle Franchise Protection Act by restating that an auto manufacturer is prohibited from owning a vehicle dealership. Current state regulation is meant to create a clear division between the business rights and responsibilities of the new vehicle dealers, the franchisees, on the one hand, and the motor vehicle manufacturers, the franchisors, on the other. State law is necessary in this situation to ensure fairness in these contracts because of the enormous disparity in bargaining power between the Minnesota franchisee, which are small business owners, and the global automakers. We have hundreds of small, mostly family-owned businesses here throughout Minnesota in which millions of dollars of hard-earned money have been invested that need continued protection. These dealers, you should know, represent about 16,000 jobs in the state of Minnesota. The franchise dealership system, which has been in place since the earliest days of the auto industry, has worked very well in each state. Last year, there were 14.5 million new cars and trucks sold in the U.S., and the system works for many reasons, one of them being that the manufacturers have strict requirements that dealerships must follow in order to be able to sell their vehicles, repair them, and represent the brands to the public. We're concerned about the possible consumer protection angles that may exist if the dealership is not part of the equation. For example, many independent dealers continue to stay in business and provide services even if the auto company or their brand shuts down and they stop selling a supply of new vehicles. If the manufacturer, without dealers, were to close its company-owned stores and store and service facilities, these customers would likely be left without any recourse. For example, on the roads today, owners of Oldsmobiles, Pontiacs, Hummers, Saabs, Daewoos, Isuzus, and other vanished lines are able to access parts and services for their vehicles through the independent dealers which exist even long after those brands have disappeared. Under current Minnesota law, as well as other states in the country, a motor vehicle manufacturer, for example, Ford, General Motors, Toyota, etc., are prohibited from selling directly to consumers in competition to the franchisee because of the unfair competition which would result. Several states, I should let you know, are already looking at this very similar legislation. As dealers look long-term into the future, we see various factors facing the global auto industry, the possibility of entire lines being rebranded, and emerging manufacturers' desire to operate free from regulations that apply to the current business model. As I said, this has prompted several states to address this similar legislation in their legislatures. Again, what is being sought in this bill is simply a clarification of the existing state law, which prohibits manufacturers from owning dealerships. And my last thing I will add is that the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers, which is a national organization representing most of the major automakers, considers this bill to be a clarification of existing statute and will not be opposed to it. And thank you very much, and I can stand for questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Milner? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the amendment, could you just tell me what a medium-speed electric vehicle is?
Medium-speed electric?
Miller?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal. I'm not entirely 100% sure on the answer to that question. I think it might be like a... I'm not exactly sure on a medium-speed electric vehicle. The whole point of that amendment is simply to clarify that we're not reaching out broadly to every sort of motorized vehicle on the roads. We're simply just dealing with passenger automobiles and trucks. But I'll get you an answer to your question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Comments? Concerns? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, do we have a problem we're sensing on the horizon with the manufacturers coming in and trying to own dealerships? And are they not able to take care of this in the contracts that they, or the, can't the franchisees take care of this in the contracts that they have with the manufacturers?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Runbeck, for asking that question. You've just identified exactly what the concern is that by virtue of the really unlevel playing field, the sort of strength that the global-wide manufacturers have, if you're just a humble little dealer here in Minnesota, you don't quite have the same bargaining power. And again, this is primarily, it's aimed to just be a clarification, but it is born out of the fact that we're concerned about what's happening elsewhere and why other states are taking the same steps that we are. We just want to make sure that we get ahead of it before it becomes an issue where we've got giant manufacturing pushing down on some little Minnesota dealership.
Okay. Thank you.
And with that, Mr. Chairman, I am aware of one other testifier. We have not had, as Mr. Milner referenced, all of the manufacturers are good with this based on the organization, what is it, NAMA?
Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers.
But I am aware of, I believe, Tesla Motors does have some concern about it, and I wanted to make sure that they had an opportunity to testify as well.
Come on up. Let's see, Jeffrey Evanson. Excuse me. Jeremy O'Connell.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr.
Scotsman.
Chairman. Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dermot O'Connell, and I'm an executive with Tesla Motors. Tesla Motors is a small, new manufacturer of only electric vehicles. We were started some 8 years ago. We introduced, the mission of the company is to catalyze a market for electric vehicles in a way that no other manufacturer, traditional manufacturer, has been able to do. We are very interested in coming to Minnesota and offering our products. The product in question is referred to as the Tesla Model S. It's a premium sedan which has garnered many notable industry awards in the past year, notably the Motor Trend Car of the Year Award. We are a humble, small guy, as it were, as was just described here. Our vehicles have many attributes that I think are consistent with the values of the citizenry of Minnesota. They are zero gasoline. They are zero emissions. And they hold the promise, by view of their advanced technology, of really bringing more of these vehicles to market through competition with other manufacturers. We have never had a franchise dealership, and in that respect, and under the current law, absent this amendment, there is no bar to us coming to Minnesota. In fact, we're already looking at a location at the Mall of America for a store. Think about an Apple store. Our retail points of sale are information-based, and they're located in malls. We will be opening a service center, if we're permitted to do so, in Edina. We also offer home service to our clients. Our vehicles are of necessity right now, rather high-priced, and so premium vehicles. We expect to sell perhaps a couple of hundred in any given year in Minnesota. As such, we represent no damage to any existing dealer, as we've never had a dealership and will not be competing with any existing dealer. We understand the potential threat, as described by my colleague over here, of large-scale manufacturers coming into the market, perhaps notably Chinese manufacturers who've never had dealerships and exploiting the law as currently written. And in that context, we have discussed with the Dealers Association a very narrow carve-out that would permit Tesla Motors, an American car company based in California, employing thousands of engineers and line manufacturing associates, and supported by the Obama administration and the DOE and a DOE loan, to come to Minnesota. So with that, I thank you for your consideration. I would ask you to look at this amendment carefully in view of the equities that I'm presenting here, and I'd be very pleased to answer any of your questions.
Mr. O'Connell, I've been waiting for you to show up with one of these vehicles and give us a ride in it, because I read so much about it. But anyway,
we're very, very anxious to do so, and I think our ability to do that and our interest in doing so is to a degree informed by the result of this and other proceedings here. I have a colleague, our Vice President of Investor Relations, who is in fact based here in Minnesota, and he would himself, I know, be very anxious to bring the car up here and display it.
Are there any questions? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Connell, as your business grows, do you foresee using the dealership model?
At this point, no, and I thank you for the question. Yeah. The reason why we're proceeding as we are is because electric vehicles have a somewhat tortured history over the course of time. A part of that is the fact that in the absence of dedicated stores such as we have, which are focused on educating a consumer about a new technology, it's not necessarily in the interest of a traditional dealer to support this new technology at the expense of the products that they're already selling of technology that's very well known, internal combustion engine vehicles or even hybrid vehicles for that point. That's the theory under which we're proceeding with our business model.
Other questions or comments? Anybody else? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have you been in contact with the author and had any discussions about how you might proceed in this market? And what were the results of those?
Mr. O'Connell.
Yes. I have not personally. We've had, through intermediaries, we've had some meetings scheduled. But as I referred to earlier, we have had discussions recently, as recently as yesterday, with the Dealers Association, hoping to achieve a small amendment to the amendment, as it were. I don't want to indulge in the nomenclature, that would permit uniquely our operation in the public benefit, we believe. And so we stand very constructive. I should mention that we operate in almost a dozen states right now. State laws is hybrid across the United States in this regard. We operate always within the parameters of the law, and we've operated very successfully. There is, to be fair, a movement that is trying to bar us from other markets, but we've taken the good citizen approach, and we're really trying to work this out in a constructive fashion.
Okay. Any other questions of the witness? Representative Atkins, you'd like to
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's all right, I'll just stay right here. I did want to, Tesla is well represented by Mr. McAsey. I'm confident that we'll be able to work out something with them. We're not trying to keep Tesla out of the state of Minnesota, although we were a little disappointed that they didn't bring samples. Normally in Minnesota, there's a tradition that you bring each of the committee members samples of your product, but maybe next time, Mr. O'Connell. But I'm confident we've got to go to the Commerce Committee next, Mr. Chairman. I'm confident that we'll be able to work out some language between the dealers and the folks at Tesla to try to address the concern.
Well, I think we're prepared then for a vote. I see no other comments or questions, and the vote would be to vote on House File 774 as amended, and refer to the Commerce Committee. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
You're on the way to the Commerce Committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members.
This guy never showed up, or whatever. Okay. House File 753, Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move House File 753.
Okay. The department wants us to hold this over. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is relatively short. I'll keep my comments brief, and then I'll turn it over to the testifier in support of the bill. But essentially what we're talking about here is vehicle-mounted red lights. And as it was presented to me that because of the need to keep the near-exclusive usage of forward-projecting red lights to law enforcement and emergency vehicles under existing law, only the Commissioner of Public Safety may authorize any other vehicle to mount red lights for usage on the roadway and only in very select circumstances. However, there is another statute, 169.04, which states that no locality may, by ordinance or regulation, prohibit the use of red lights. DPS feels that the two statutes are not inconsistent with each other and can certainly be interpreted together. But some private parties who wish to use red lights on vehicles have advanced persistent arguments that 169.04 somehow trumps the DPS commissioner's blanket authority of 169.64 to regulate the use of red lights. So for this reason, DPS proposes to repeal those portions of 169.04 that deal with red lights so that this conflict of laws situation is abolished and the statutes are crystal clear that any mounting of red lights on non-emergency vehicles requires approval by the Commissioner of DPS. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to a testifier from the Minnesota State Patrol.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Silkey. I'm a major with the Minnesota State Patrol. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Department of Public Safety appreciates Representative Simonson authoring the bill and the opportunity for the legislature to review this issue on behalf of all stakeholders at every level of the public safety community. The bill before you is supported by the Department of Public Safety and is an agency initiative of the State Patrol and the Commissioner of Public Safety. The bill is intended to address a very important provision for public safety and emergency response. We have always believed it is imperative in public safety that red lights be strictly limited and controlled. The purpose of the bill is to establish clarity with existing statutes relating to the authority to use red lights with the intent to restrict red lights to emergency vehicles. Before pointing out the pertinent statutes, I'd like to briefly review a few statutes related to emergency vehicles, and those should have been passed out for your reference. Emergency response, sometimes life-saving to the public we serve, is critical for those requiring the aid of emergency responders. The public response to an emergency vehicle impacts our ability to quickly respond to an emergency and impacts the safety of emergency responders. By the very nature of emergency vehicle response, emergency vehicles must have obedience and compliance with respect to response to red lights displayed by emergency vehicles. Red lights are designed to immediately get the attention of the public so they are alerted to emergency responders. I would direct you to the right-of-way statute, which is a handout 169.20, subdivision 5, is important to emergency responders as it requires traffic to yield to emergency vehicles. Specifically, it states that upon the immediate approach of an authorized emergency vehicle equipped with at least one lighted lamp exhibiting a red light, the driver of each other vehicle shall yield the right-of-way and shall immediately drive to a position parallel to and as close as possible to the right-hand edge of curb or the highway, clear of any intersection, and shall stop and remain in this position until the authorized emergency vehicle has passed, except when otherwise directed by a police officer. Because of the need to keep the near-exclusive usage of forward-projecting red lights to law enforcement and emergency vehicles, under existing law, Minnesota Statute 169.64, Subdivision 2, only the Commissioner of Public Safety may authorize any other vehicle to mount red lights for usage on the roadway and only in select circumstances. I refer to the statute that should be handed out. Subdivision 2 speaks specifically to colored lights, and unless otherwise authorized by the Commissioner of Public Safety, no vehicle shall be equipped, nor shall any person drive or move any vehicle or equipment upon any highway with any lamp or device displaying a red light or any colored light other than those required or permitted in this chapter of 169. In addition, an additional statute identified 169.011, subdivision 3, defines the authorized emergency vehicles. Subdivision 3 speaks specifically about the Commissioner of Public Safety's ability to designate and grant the authority to an authorized emergency vehicle. And we know that this is, of course, inclusive of fire, police, ambulance, and rescue squads as well. So subdivision 3 speaks to the authorized emergency vehicle, meaning equipped and identified according to the law, and a vehicle is designated as an authorized emergency vehicle upon a finding by the Commissioner of Public Safety that designation of that vehicle is necessary to the preservation of life or property or to the execution of emergency governmental functions. Currently, anyone that applies for an emergency vehicle permit through the Commissioner's office is required to include an affidavit from the applicant that describes the use of the vehicle in the manner required. So it must require that the designation of that vehicle is necessary for the preservation of life or property or to the execution of emergency governmental functions. They must also describe how the operation of the vehicle is included in emergency operations and response plans of local law enforcement, firefighting, emergency medical services, or emergency management departments. They must also provide a letter of endorsement on official stationery from the governmental body that benefits from the service of the vehicle for which the authorization is requested, and must be signed by someone in authority of the governmental body in which there is a follow-up verification process as well. They must also provide information related to training and insurance providing coverage as an emergency vehicle, and in addition, the applicant provides consent for a criminal background check and pays the fee. Clearly, the application process by the Commissioner of Public Safety is intended to require review and scrutiny, as significant efforts are made to ensure red lights be strictly limited and controlled by the Commissioner of Public Safety. Bonafide emergency responders are required to go through all of these provisions. Yet, there is another statute, 169.04, which is reflected in House File 753. On lines 2.5 through 2.11, which states that no locality may, by ordinance or regulation, prohibit the use of red lights. DPS feels that the two statutes are not consistent with each other and can certainly be interpreted together, but some private parties who wish to use red lights on non-emergency vehicles have advanced persistent arguments that 169.04 undergo no application process or review to utilize those red lights, to regulate the use of those lights. When these vehicles use red lights, The right-of-way requirement can create driver confusion and uncertainty if drivers are required to stop for escorts, such as funeral processions or other wide-load escorts. For these reasons, DPS proposes to repeal those portions of 169.04C, lines 2.5 through 2.11 in the bill, that deal with red lights, so that this argued conflict of laws situation is abolished. And the statutes are crystal clear that any mounting of red lights on non-emergency vehicles requires approval by the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And with respect to those impacted by the bill, this change in the bill would then require amber or yellow lighting for non-emergency vehicles that are escorting funeral processions, oversized buildings, and heavy equipment. The existing statute 169.64 subdivision 3 allows for funeral home vehicles and LPs escorting a load presenting a vehicular traffic hazard requiring unusual care in approaching, overtaking, or passing to use flashing warning lights authorized by 169.59. So there is a provision that does allow for them to continue with the lighting, but it would just be the transition from the red lights to the yellow lights. Further, under the right-of-way statute 169.20, it further addresses the requirement for drivers to yield to funeral processions. Law enforcement, ambulance operators, fire departments are universally in support of limiting red light usage to emergency vehicles. We feel it is imperative that red lights be reserved for emergency vehicles, and we ask for your support of this bill. Myself or Assistant Commissioner Danaski can take any questions that the committee may have.
Well, Major, I have a couple questions, because I lost you on 169.50, which was several subdivisions back. And so
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, 169.50?
No, that's all right. I just made that up. To the front, you can display, if I'm reading your statutes here, you can display white or ambers or any shade of color between white and amber, but not red. You're taking red off the spectrum here.
Is that Mr. Chair, that's correct, unless you're an authorized emergency vehicle.
Okay, and the lamps used to the rear can have flashing amber or red lights? That's in the next paragraph here.
Mr. Chair, I think you may be referring to 169.64,
I think you're right.
Which is the prohibited light exceptions, subdivision yes. 3. Referring to 169.64 sub 3, the flashing lights are prohibited except on authorized emergency vehicles. And so that is inclusive. It says also inclusive is the funeral home director, or excuse me, funeral home vehicle, or the presence of a vehicular traffic hazard requiring unusual care in approaching, overtaking, or passing for the escort loads. And so that does allow flashing lights. However, there is no color indicated in that statute, so it further refers you to 169.59, which then states you can either use your hazards, which could be amber or red, or if you desired under 169.59, it would allow for those vehicles to use the amber flashing or strobe rotating lights.
Well, Major, is this handout that you have, is this new language or is this what you're working from? Because I'm reading about, I want to make sure everybody knows where they can put the red lights, not in front, but possibly red lights on the rear, flashing amber or red lights, it says on here, or any shade of color between amber and red.
Mr. Chair, the only change that we're proposing is the change under 169.04 in the proposed bill by eliminating lines 2.5 through 2.11 and striking that text. We believe that would create the situation where there would not be a provision where these other non-emergency vehicles could mount or display the red lights.
I think I have to take your word for it. What you're saying is what you really want, but okay. I didn't follow you through each statute because I don't think we have that, or whatever you gave me, I'm reading differently. So can you summarize what you said by saying no red lights on to the front on non-emergency vehicles, and to the rear we can do what? Besides the statute, can you tell me what you really want?
Sure. Mr. Chair, actually, we would restrict so no vehicle that is not identified as an emergency vehicle could have any red lights mounted or displayed unless it is approved through the Commissioner of Public Safety via a permit. If it is not an authorized emergency vehicle through the jurisdiction in which they work. Mr. Chair, I can give you a few examples of situations. There are some locations outstate, for example, where maybe an emergency medical director, where they only have an ambulance and they're operating as a trauma doctor through the hospital, and as an emergency medical director, they would make an application on occasion. We do have those. There are not a lot of emergency vehicle applications that are approved through the Commissioner of Public Safety, but that would be an example, and our intent would be to restrict and limit that.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions or comments on this? No. Well, I'm disappointed. You all followed it very well. Representative Beard, I know you have one.
Well, I have Major Silky. A question about, kind of related, but you talk about emergency move over stuff. I'm thinking about, practically speaking, when we're on the freeways and everybody's doing 65 or so, and here comes an ambulance or a squad car in the left lane, it seems to me that the letter of the law, moving over to the shoulder and stopping, is more dangerous than just moving over and slowing down. Is that what, can you clarify that? Is that what we're actually supposed to do, technically, is move over and stop when there's somebody coming, even if it's on a freeway at freeway speeds?
Technically, the law does list a pullover and stop, but it isn't uncommon, Representative Beard, for the vehicles to slow and move a lane away and allow the emergency vehicle to safely pass.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? We will lay your bill. Or would you like to sum anything? Maybe you could sum those statutes again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think I'll pass on that.
Okay. Well, we will lay over House File 753 for possible inclusion in the bill. And, thank you.
Great.
Representative Clark. House File 348. I'll move House File 348 for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two amendments, one of which I think just came to me and it's just being passed out.
Okay.
The other one I believe you all should have in your folder. So if you could move those two amendments, I would put the bill in the order that the author would prefer.
One is in the folder.
And then we can go through it.
I will move Amendment H.O. 348A1. What can you ask for something? Yeah. All in favor of that amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The amendment is adopted. I will also move. We don't have a number on this one. Well, then we move on to the we'll have to wait on the second one, so I will not move that. And you begin your testify, please. Council did not prepare this, and we're having council look at this right now.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This came actually from the Department of Public Safety, so can we get it fixed up for the presentation today?
Well, go ahead and start your
okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and bienvenidos, amigos. I just want to say the bill I'm bringing forward today is a bill that would modify the procedures and some of the requirements for obtaining a driver's license in Minnesota. And it's a bill that's a provision that's exists in four other states: Utah, Illinois, New Mexico, and Washington State. And we have a number of witnesses who will talk with you about the importance of this legislation. It's really a strong public safety issue. People who do not have legal documents and are not able to get driver's licenses in the state of Minnesota anymore. And this will make it possible for them to get the driver's licenses, which means they will be able to get insurance. And we have a number of people speaking from the community and from law enforcement. And I'd just like to go ahead, Mr. Chairman, with some of the supportive testimony, if that's okay, and then we can have questions. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Robert Lilligren. I am the Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council, and I will be speaking from the city's position today. I also represent a core city community just south of downtown Minneapolis that contains a number of new arrival populations in my constituents. I'm speaking on their behalf as well. The City of Minneapolis' official position on this is legislation. We support legislation that modifies the Minnesota driver's license procedures to allow information regarding the applicant to be gathered from an ID card issued by a government other than the United States. We support House File 348 as we believe it's consistent with our position, and it would have the effect of allowing people to apply for and receive driver's license in the state of Minnesota regardless of their documentation status. This is a very important issue to the city of Minneapolis, where we are a city of inclusiveness, and it is the city has derived this position through a lengthy community engagement process, and I think committee members have been provided with a couple of policy recommendations that have come forward from our recent Latino engagement task force of our neighborhood community relations department. And we believe, as Representative Clark, who is my representative, stated that this is a public safety issue, and it would create safer roads by increasing the number of licensed drivers on our roads and decrease the number of uninsured drivers. Minneapolis is home to the largest immigration population in Minnesota, and we believe that we've sort of foreshadowed the future of Minnesota and the continuing growth through immigration. And we believe that through this measure, we're helping to build stronger relationships with our immigrant community. And it's not just a public safety issue, although when you reflect that 80% of drivers in our state drive to work and that the immigration population makes up 8.3% of the state workforce, at least in 2010. That's almost a quarter of a million workers. You see that it has an economic impact as well. And the Latino-owned buying power within the state of Minnesota is $5.1 billion. Latino-owned businesses have sales and receipts of $1.6 billion and employ about 6,000 people. And unauthorized immigrants in Minnesota paid $81.7 million in state and local taxes in 2010. I live on Lake Street, very near where 35W crosses Lake Street, and I've lived on this block for 30 years, and I have seen some very grim times in my time living on Lake Street in South Minneapolis. And it has been a joy and a pleasure to watch Lake Street, East Lake Street, where I live, become revitalized and re-energized, primarily based on the immigrant energy and investment that we've seen within the community. So this is in response to an urgent need identified by the community. I attended several community meetings, hundreds of community members. I've heard dozens and dozens of stories. You'll hear some very similar of families that have been separated, broken apart, families living in fear and risk because of the lack of a driver's license, families unable to access jobs or education or other opportunities. So this is key importance to the people that I represent, and it is supported by the state of Minnesota, and I would ask for your support on House File 348, and I'm free here to answer questions. We also have city staff on hand as well. Thank you.
Representative Hornsey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Council Member Lilligren. Also, thank you for all of your incredible work that you do on transportation and other issues. I just wanted to make sure that the committee saw, handout from the city titled Robert Lilligren, Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council. There's a square, a red square at the top under impact, we all win.
Right.
And I think especially that third, fourth bullet point around promoting integration and collaboration. If you could talk for just a second and Representative Clark as well. You know, once in a while there's some amendments on the House floor that we that have never passed, but once in a while we'll get a member that doesn't want Minneapolis to enforce our ordinances around police-community relations where we have a system where the immigration status isn't asked for. And if you could comment a little about how this issue relates to that and how important it is that our, from a public safety standpoint, that we have positive police-community relations, as this ID issue, I think, very much relates to that. If you could maybe comment a little bit for the committee on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, thanks for your kind words as well. And I would note that committee members were provided with a packet that does have the notes that I just spoke from. It also has policy recommendations and sort of a frequently asked questions or a did you know page as well. And Representative Hornstein, Mr. Chair, I agree these are related, and this is about the relationship between the communities and law enforcement. And Minneapolis has long been concerned with that relationship, and we hesitate to do anything that would cause our residents to hesitate engaging law enforcement when needed, that would create fear between the communities that are policed and law enforcement. We believe that our community benefits and that everybody wins, as the notes say and as we say, Representative Hornstein, when there is a positive relationship between our residents in the city of Minneapolis and law enforcement, when our residents feel they can approach law enforcement when they need it without fear of jeopardizing their residency here based on their immigration status.
Representative Hornstein.
And just one quick, not so much a question, but I looked around. I saw that I'm the only Minneapolis rep on this committee, which is good. I'm glad Minneapolis is represented. But as the Minneapolis rep members, I do want to extend an invitation for you to tour this area that Councilmember Lilligren was talking about along Lake Street. You know, we have the Sears building. We have the Mercado. We have so many incredible small businesses that this community and other immigrant communities have been working at, and I think I'm sure that Representative Clark and Councilmember Lilligren and I can give you a very uplifting tour of this area, because you have to see it. It's really changed over the years, and I believe changed for the better. So just inviting the committee, maybe after deadline, maybe during the interim, a summer afternoon, we can tour this area together, and I think you would be really pleased at what you see.
Representative Hornstein, I got to tell you that many, many years ago, I've always had convertibles at hand, and that was the thing to do, was getting your convertible on a nice day, like you used to say, or you just said, and drive up and down Lake Street. And I'd be glad to do that again.
Okay, so the chair is signed up. We hope others will.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, if I could just say one thing, and it's many of the people who are in this room who are the people who have created that wonderful environment for you. Not only is it a safe and interesting place to tour, it's also a great place to get delicious food. So I hope people will come. Thank you. I have a couple other witnesses, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Ignacio Amigón.
Please give your name for the tape to identify yourself. Thank you.
Sí, bueno, mi nombre es Ignacio Amigón.
Hello, my name is Ignacio Amigón.
Okay.
Y tengo cinco niños, y la razón que estoy aquí y estamos acá mucha gente es porque necesitamos la licencia para manejar.
I have five children, and the reason that we are here is because we desperately need this driver's license to be able to drive.
Para llevar a nuestros niños más que nada a la escuela, al hospital. A veces los niños quieren salir a divertirse, y uno por no tener licencia les niega ese derecho.
we need this license. We need licenses to be able to take our children to school, to the hospital at times, and sometimes our children ask us to take them to recreational activities, and we are forced to deny them that.
Antes yo tenía licencia hace 16 años, pero la última vez que la fui a renovar fue negada por no tener papeles.
So I used to have a driver's license. 16 years ago I got a driver's license, but the last time that I went to renew my driver's license, it was denied because I didn't have the proper papers.
Y ahora la verdad me siento mal porque tengo hijos grandes ya, pero tengo hijos pequeños también, y a veces me piden que los lleve al fútbol o a divertirse al Mall America, y es difícil andar sin licencia ahora porque la verdad es como no tener pies, yo creo.
Often I have grown children, but I also have younger children, and sometimes they ask me to take them to a soccer game or to the Mall of America, I can't, we really need driver's licenses because not being able to drive is almost like not being able to walk.
Bueno, y más que nada también se ocupa para ir a trabajar y no andar en autobús o la verdad que sí, si los pudieran ayudar pues a todos y a mí para que los dieran la licencia, sería magnífico.
We also would need driver's licenses or benefit us so we could not have to rely on public transportation, especially for work, and if you could find it within your powers to help us to and myself and personally, it would be magnificent.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Questions or other for the witness? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondered, I realized you said you had last had a driver's license 16 years ago, and was that in the U.S. or was that elsewhere?
De aquí de Minnesota, porque antes la verdad ibas a sacar tu ID con antes nomás ibas con tu pura acta de nacimiento y sacabas tu ID y sacabas tu licencia, pero después han cambiado las leyes y ahora es difícil.
That was a driver's license issued from Minnesota. It was a Minnesota driver's license because before we were able to obtain a driver's license with a birth certificate or other proof of identification, but then it changed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to, be kind of amazed. I mean, 16 years you've been in this in the state. No English.
Yeah, I speak little English, yeah.
Okay.
I understand too, but I speak little, not much, but because when I stay here, I start to work, and I never go to school in Minnesota, but I got 5 kids. It's hard when you got like 5 kids. You need to work. I got 2 jobs every time, but now I got only 1 job because I don't have a driver's license, and somebody give me a ride, and it's hard. You don't have a license, it's very hard. So.
Oh, Mr. Chair, sir, your English is wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have another one.
Representative Newberger.
Oh, there's another question. Wait.
Thank you. Are there more testifiers coming? Or there?
Yes, I think you have other.
There's one more. All right, I'll hold. I'll wait until.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to call Raquel Vinces.
Welcome to the committee. Please give your name for the tape.
Hi, I'm Raquel Vences. First and foremost, I would like to thank all of you for taking your time to hear me and hear my story. I am an American citizen. I am a voter and also a taxpayer. I come from a family of five. Thanks to my parents' hard work and dedication, they have been able to put three of us in private colleges. This would have never happened if they would have never had that dedication to work hard for us. Unfortunately, one of my parents is undocumented and is now currently with no driver's license. And this has made it really hard because he needs to find work far away from us. And this is hard because it's not because of choice that he's far. It's because he needs to find work in order to help me and my siblings stay in school and better our future. This is not just my story that I'm sharing. This is a story of all the people here, because I know a lot of us share similar stories where we are separated from our families because we are unable to, well, our family members are unable to obtain a driver's license. All my siblings are American citizens. They're also voters. This would affect all of us a lot because like I mentioned, my father is not undocumented, and if he's not able to find work, then he is unable to help us finance our education and better our future. And I ask you guys to please support the bill. This is very important, not just for me, but also for all the Latino community here in Minnesota, because we are growing, and it's 2013, and we need change.
Questions? Not yet. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
You have...
Mr. Chairman, I guess there is one more witness, Suzanne De Leon. Susanna? Oh, two? Yeah, okay. There's a team.
Good afternoon. My name is Susanna De Leon. I am an immigration attorney, and...
My name is Bruce Nestor. I'm a law partner with Ms. De Leon, as well as life partner, I guess.
I wanted to bring to your attention some legal arguments with regard to the need for driver's licenses and with how we might view the issue with the immigrant community. Immigration law is tremendously complicated. It is... so confusing and complicated that, you know, it is truly every day we have to be reading up and looking at what's new. And for that reason, I know that many of my clients might be undocumented today and may have status tomorrow. And in particular, this fluidity of immigration law is exemplified in laws such as the DREAM Act, or the recent deferred action for childhood arrivals, where, you know, one day 1.7 estimated high school students or young people under 30 were here without documents, and the next day they were able to apply for deferred action. Now, of those people, there are about 6,000 of those dreamers here in Minnesota. And now, you know, I have seen hundreds of them go through my office, and they all now have driver's licenses and social security numbers. That is just one example, but we also have temporary protected status for people who come from countries where there has been a natural disaster, and the government protects them so they won't have to return to a country that cannot support them. Or for victims of crime, people who are victims of crime or women who have suffered domestic abuse, they can apply under VAWA for special protection. And all of my clients, you know, that fall within those categories will be able to have status within a year. And even for VAWA people, they become qualified immigrants, and they're able to apply for government benefits. And yet, if they don't get their driver's license, I mean their work permit in a year, they're still, you know, not able to get a driver's license. Mm-hmm. So it exemplifies, you know, the difficulties and the complexities of this issue. And, you know, I would just say that given that everything can change so rapidly, and hopefully it will change even more, that it just makes sense for the state of Minnesota to go back to the time, as you know, Ignacio was saying, where we could obtain a driver's license showing who we are, proving our identity, and you know, being in a database where you know someone knows who we are, and we can comply with the laws by having a driver's license and driving with a driver's license. Thank you.
Again, my name is Bruce Nestor, and I'm an immigration attorney and attorney in South Minneapolis. What a lot of the testimony you've heard about, both from the community members and from Ms. De Leon, is what we talk about is mixed status families that exist throughout all parts of Minnesota, rural Minnesota and urban Minnesota, where some members are citizens, maybe a parent is a citizen, or the children certainly are, where brothers and sisters are citizens. Some are legal permanent residents. Some may be in the process of acquiring status. Others are have temporary protected status. And what we're talking about, and I think what the testimony goes to, is the ability to really fully integrate these families into our community and to strengthen our community, in that we're talking people who are here where they're citizens and permanent residents and some who are undocumented. And it's like, how do you take your kids to hockey practice if you don't have a driver's license? How do you take your kid to school, you know, your U.S. citizen children to school into after school events if you don't have a driver's license? The second part of this is really from a public safety perspective. I think the testimony so far has been about the kind of it as a human rights and about building our community. You know, the driver's license database is the largest law enforcement database in the country. If the purpose of that database is so that law enforcement can identify you when law enforcement encounters you as a crime victim or as a witness or driving your motor vehicle, we're talking about adding, you know, nationwide we'd be adding about 12 million people to the largest and most comprehensive database that exists that has biometric information in the form of photographs and unique identifiers in terms of dates of birth and names. In Minnesota, we're talking about increasing the ability of law enforcement to identify the people that they encounter and to know exactly who they're dealing with. We're talking about conserving and saving state and local law enforcement resources that are now used jailing people for no driver's license violations, something that may stem solely from really their lack of status and not from any sort of criminal intent or behavior. We're talking, I believe, that studies will show that when states have extended driver's license, that rates of car insurance go up, and of course rates of uninsured drivers and rates of unlicensed drivers go down. And so what we're really asking for in this bill is that the Department of Motor Vehicles perform its core function, which is to make sure they can identify people to whom they're issuing a license, to make sure that those people know how to drive and can pass the driver safety test, and to perform a core function, and not to try to serve as federal immigration agents in what is a very complicated and ever-changing immigration landscape, where we know that many, many people who are undocumented today are going to become residents and citizens tomorrow, and it's about strengthening and including them in our community today, rather than just waiting to do it in the future.
Are there any questions for Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. This is for Representative Clark. I'm looking at the bill. First and foremost, I want to say that this is an issue that does need to be addressed, and I think that this allowing access to for people to get their driver's license is a good thing. Okay. So let me preface this by saying that I am not opposed to people getting their driver's license. And I agree with the attorneys here in as much as once you have your driver's license, you have to go through a series of education to learn how to be a safe driver, so everybody wins. Where I need some clarification here is if you start on line 3.1, first and foremost, I think that the definition of a government identification card needs to be refined. That's a little bit vague. I'm just gonna paint a picture here. If I show up and my government identification card is from Romania and it's dated 19. No, I'm not. That Romanian is a Latin-based language. I'm gonna use a Cyrillic-based language. Let's say it's in Russian. Okay, it's Cyrillic. I don't read Cyrillic. Let's say I show up and I have my government identification card is from Uzbekistan, and it's dated 1948. The problems that we need to do is we need to refine. We need to have a little bit to refine this a little bit, because if I show, how do you know? All you have here is a government identification card that says full name and date of birth of the cardholder. Well, if I don't read Russian, how do I know what this card says? If I don't speak Spanish, how do I know what this card says? I'm working at the driver's license bureau, and someone puts this card in front of me. How do I know what it says if I can't read that language? This needs to be refined. Also, will the government agency or the person at the driver's at the bureau, will they be able to say no? This doesn't meet our standard. The other thing here is in line 311, we have security features that make a card as impervious to alteration as reasonably practical in its design and quality of material and technology using materials that are not readily available to the general public. That differs depending on what nation you're in. An ID card from Finland is going to be a lot different than an ID card from Iraq. Okay, so I support this, but there needs to be some parameters by which we define this, because if I show up with a paper card from Uzbekistan that's in Cyrillic that's dated 1947, according to this bill, that's okay, because who knows that that's the best security provision that they had at the time when they produced the card. The other concern that I have is what if the card is from a nation that is currently being sanctioned officially by the United States of America, Cuba, for instance, or Iran, for instance. These are just questions that just need to be hammered out. And again, what I'm trying to say is I'm not against this, but we need to have some parameters here, so you just to make this reasonable. And that is something that I want to encourage you to work on in an amendment form or something here. But just to simply say a government identification card is all that you need, if it has, you know, this information on here, let's get a few more parameters to this so that it's reasonable. That's all that I'm asking for here. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that comment, and I do think you raise an issue in terms of there being available translators, and we do have people here from the Department of Public Safety who could maybe talk about how they handle this. I'm sure this isn't totally new now, but I think Mr. Nestor also wanted to mention a comment, and I think I just want to say I would certainly be willing to put language in here that says that translation be available for the Department of Public Safety, and maybe we could hear from them in a minute about how they would handle that. But Mr. Nestor, did you want to respond?
I do believe that probably the DMV could address it directly, but already existing law, for instance, allows a foreign passport to be presented as a primary document along with an immigration document. So that foreign passport, of course, could be in Cyrillic or could be from 1948 too. So it really doesn't change anything other than existing law, both in terms of a primary document, and for instance, the existing rules provide that a secondary document for purposes of applying for a driver's license can be a foreign birth certificate from a jurisdiction other than the United States. Of course, that birth certificate would typically be in Spanish or Cyrillic or whatever. For an older person, could also be an old document. And I think finally, I, and again, perhaps the staff from DMV could address this, I believe that the language here about security features is really kind of a term of art. I believe that the commissioner and the DMV can testify that there really is extraordinary cooperation between motor vehicle licensing departments, particularly in the Americas with Canada and Mexico, and that major steps have been taken in the past decade to ensure that there's our uniform security documents that can't be altered or forged, and that there's a process to make sure those are assigned to a unique individual. So I most of those, I believe, are both issues that already exist with current licensing and are addressed probably by the departmental staff on a daily basis.
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, I'd like to ask Pat McCormick to come down from the Department of Motor Vehicles, just right here, and to probably
okay
respond to that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety.
Welcome.
In terms of the, you know, the current rules, which are repealed in here, do provide us with primary and secondary documents that we use in order to verify identification. And what we require right now are some of the ones that we would be looking at would be birth certificates from other government jurisdictions. They have to be a certified copy, so it has to be translated so that we're able to read them. As I think one of the testifiers was saying, there are documents now or booklets that are now coming out that are starting to show driver's licenses and ID cards from other states, I mean from other countries, but those aren't things that we normally have. But and when we take a driver's license application, we're what we call a central issue state. So while they take it at the exam station or the driver license agent office, all those applications come into our central office and they're reviewed again and entered into the system. So we have two reviews that happen so that we're sure that we're preventing fraud and we're sure of the identification of the individual. So certainly there can be tools that would assist us in being able to determine that the security features of the car, of the identification cards are accurate, the documents that are presented are scanned as well so that we have a scanned image of them that we can use in order to be able to identify them. And certainly one card that has been used that has significantly changed over the years. It isn't a document that is on our list currently, but there are countries where they have made significant improvements in having more security features and ensuring people's identity before they issue them. The Mexican matricular consular card, I think, consular card is one of those. That isn't one that is on our list because at the time they weren't considered secure documents. There weren't security features. But in general, across the that is getting to be more primary concern of most countries now, and so there is an effort to try to improve the security features of cards. But certainly our staff would have to be trained and learn about those different security features.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question, were there questions for Ms. McCormick, by the way? Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Yes, we're hearing a side of this story, and I think there's a little more to the story I'd like to just have shared with the committee, because this is an important issue for us to consider. Ms. McCormick, we've heard the assertion that up until 16 years ago, undocumented or illegal people in the country could get a driver's license in Minnesota, and then they couldn't. Can you tell us what changed and what they used to use to get a driver's license and what kind of driver's license it was? That might be helpful to inform us as we think about this.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, I wasn't in driver services, that driver and vehicle services, that long ago. Our driver services program director may have some information on that. In 2004 was when these rules were developed. This has been in place since then. And we did have other rules that had different documents that prior to that. But for one card that I can remember since I started with DVS, which was in 2000, was the I-99 document, which was just a piece of paper that had writing on it. And that document, which is it was an immigration document, mm-hmm. but we did have to drop that document because it was just a piece of paper and there was no way that we could verify it didn't have a seal on it, it didn't have anything. And so those were documents that at that time when people were starting to be concerned about ensuring people's identity and the security issues, that was when that document was no longer allowed. So I think what you're talking about is in the days prior to that, everything was just paper documents. You didn't have the certification that we require on most documents in today's world. And in general, in other countries, because we're part of the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, and we have members from Mexico as well as Canada and that group, and just in North America, all the cards now and all the requirements must have security features, and you must be able to prove your identity, that you are who you say you are.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beer.
I think the issue is one that certainly merits our consideration. I think people of goodwill would like to do good work with this. I know the world changed after September of 2001, because I came in 2002, and Ms. McCormick, you and I sat through a lot of committees where Homeland Security and TSA are pushing things on us and requiring us to come into compliance, or strongly suggesting it under threat of losing federal funds, and some other things you've heard me cry and complain about. So I'm just setting the stage here, especially for the new members on the committee, that this has been a changing dynamic that not all of us have been happy with over the last decade or so, but that there's more to the story here. And before we, Mr. Chairman, I guess this is my advice or request of you, that if we're going to move this bill and do something with it, can we have it in committee for another week or so that we can drill down a little deeper and actually do work that can actually benefit some people and still protect national security, national sovereignty, and using it for government identification purposes and so on? Because I think you'll find there are people around here that would like to actually do good work. But my sense is in the next 20 minutes, we're probably not going to get to the bottom of that. So just my request of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. And I would also agree with Representative Beard. And, you know, this has been, we had not a similar but not dissimilar issue several years ago with Real ID. And what I liked about the Real ID issue is it really united. It was bipartisan. There were people left and right and center that came together. I think we had an amendment on the House floor that passed with over 100 votes, I believe. And so I think there is incredible amount of goodwill and bipartisan around this issue. And you're absolutely right, Representative Beard, because a lot of this changed after 9/11. And there's a legitimate concern about terrorists, but we don't have terrorists that are impacted by this bill. We have hardworking people that are paying taxes, that are living in our communities, that are contributing, that are educating their skills, that are their kids that bring incredible skills to the country, creating small businesses, revitalizing communities. And so what you said, Representative Beard, hits home so well, because if there are issues that impact our national security, let's deal with those. But if there's overreach by the government, where we're have a one-size-fits-all approach, which I think this is, and it's hurting people that are contributing to our country, then let's parse those out. And I think from the Representative Neuberger's comment, I think we can actually get a good bipartisan bill out of this committee if we just work on a few things. And so I hope maybe we could lay it over for possible inclusion, or lay it over for more work, because I'm confident we can get this bill out of committee bipartisanly. And what a great example that would set for other legislation and to this great community. Bienvenidos.
Representative Clark, I would like to...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know your work on this has gone back years, and I think it's a really common sense idea. And I look forward to working with Representative Beard and members of the committee so we can get this to the House floor and get these people the licenses that they need. And it's a public safety issue as well, so it's only winners when this bill gets put forth. So thank you.
Representative Clark, we're going to, with counsel's help, add that Second Amendment that you had. He has some corrections. Matt, would you give the...
Mr. Chair and members, I would recommend incorporating a small change to the amendment, which would be to delete the word for and insert and applies to.
Any questions on the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, please signify saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to, Representative Clark, do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's fine. And I just want to say, with the addition of those amendments, there is no cost to this bill that was brought to us by the Department of Motor Vehicles. So.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? I see no one. Excuse me? Come down. And we have a question from Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair.
Going up there? Okay.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Faustino Rangel. Just I want to let you know my story and here in the United States of America. I live in here for like 12 years, and it's very difficult for me and for all my country, Hispanic people, because I don't have a driver license. Once I get here, I learned to speak a little English because I try to go to school as all the time when I have a little time. I start working, and when I had time, I go to school. But it was really hard for me, and it's still really hard because I can drive. I was driving for a couple of years, but the police stopped me a couple of times, and I get a lot of fines for hundreds of dollars. So I don't get much money in my works because I am illegal in this country. And it's hard because you don't have transportation for your kids. I have three kids already. And it's really, really hard because if you don't have car, if you don't have the chance to drive, it's really hard because it's not only for your kids to take them to school or to the Mall America or any. It's hard in all the sense. In all the sense because you don't have to the privilege to drive. And it's hard for me, and I think it's hard for all the people who doesn't have driver license. Because a lot of people don't have a driver license. It's not because they don't have to drive, but it's because they don't have documents to get it. And that's all what we have, the driver license. We have an ID, and we can prove that it's real or no. It's no fakes, like some people think it's fakes, or how to prove that it's real. And we can prove that it's real documents to get the driver license. And my story is about that. I have a lot of tickets because I don't have a driver license. And all these stories is maybe similar because they don't have a driver license. Now, two weeks ago, I lost my job because I can't drive. And I called three different companies. But one of those companies told me, okay, you get the job. But you have to drive at different places in one day. And I said, no, I can drive. I have a car, but I can drive. So I sell my car to different person because I can drive. And I call a different another company. They told me, okay, you can get a drive. It's really close to where you're living. Okay, it's fine. But the job they offered to me is I had to drive on weekends. And you know, on the weekends, the police is a little harder because, you know, a lot of people is in the party, drinking, and I can drive nice. It's hard for me, too, because I had no driver's license. So now I can drive, and I lost my jobs. Now I trying to get a job, but I can't get a job because I don't have a driver's license. Okay. And it's most of the story for the people here. Okay. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Ruben Urrutia. I am illegal, undocumented, and when I come to this country, somebody say me, I ask because I give me opportunity to choose what stay, and somebody say me Minnesota is the best state in United States. When I come here, I distinguish the people is so very, very comfortable while other people and have a lot of compassion for everybody, because when I come here in the church, somebody help and give me food and give me house for live, because I don't have house, because I live in the street. And I see a lot of compassion in a lot of Minnesotans, and these people teaching me English, these people show me how is the American life, and I bring my personal ideas, and I bring my personal work, and I bring my personal artistic work, and somebody say me, Ruben, you can do whatever you want here, because you are a complete artistic man. And artistic people say me, you make your art. I don't care if it's Mexican or it's whatever. And I start make my art. And I make my arches Mexican style. And I make my Mexican Hispanic art. And no stop. Because I discovered Minnesota is artistic people. And now I complete so sad. Because when I want bring huge, big art, I can do this. Because I know how driver license. I want make the Mexican calendar, and I can do my dreams, my big dreams, because I know how driver license. I want everybody pass this, please, because I don't want kill my dreams. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I realize we're running out of time. There are other people that would be willing to submit testimony in writing.
I have to shut down now.
Right, I understand.
So if you have any summary or otherwise.
Well, yes, I will summarize. Thank you so much. Committee members, I just really thank you for the hearing, and I thought your questions were excellent, and I really appreciate the statements of willingness to work on this legislation, make it better. Mr. Neuberg, I look forward to working with you. I haven't had a chance to do that in the past, and Representative Beard and other members. So, Mr. Chairman, if we could lay it over temporarily for inclusion and do some work on it, I would commit to you all that I would be happy to do that with your members. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. We will lay over this inclusion and
Mr.
the
Chair?
Omnibus bill.
Oh, Chair, just a quick yes or no question maybe of Mr. Burris. Do we still require the person verify that they have insurance at the point of getting or renewing a license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'm not sure about that. I don't believe so, and Driver and Vehicle Services could correct me or clarify if I'm off on that.
You answered, Representative Neuberg?
Just renewed mine. Didn't have to have it.
What did you say?
Interesting.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Pat McCormick, DVS, you have to attest to the fact that you have insurance at the time of the application, and there's the statute that requires it, and it's on the motor vehicle registration as well, that you have to attest to the fact that you have insurance, because the insurance the way our law works, it really involves the vehicle on the vehicle side, not necessarily on the driver's side of the law. So.
Are there any more questions, concerns from the Granny? Otherwise, I will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and gracious to all.
Okay.
Did you take a ball?
We're adjourned.